Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 1st from HPR2. It's The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. And people are wondering what to expect as the city and county of Honolulu's plastic bag ban goes into effect. Will it really make a difference? We'll hear from Suzanne Fraser of Beach Environmental Awareness Campaign Hawaii. And Governor Ige plans to veto the sex trafficking bill the legislature passed by a unanimous vote. We'll hear why a longtime supporter of the bill says that's the wrong move.
How do local, national, and global issues affect artists and their creative process? Hey Aloha Johnston from the Honolulu Museum of Art is here to tell us more. And can sharing the word on the street empower the homeless population to rebuild their lives?
The conversation starts now, right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Kathy Kosak.
Good morning.
Are you stocked up with plastic bags in line with the new law?
I'll tell you, I'm taking a look and I definitely support saving the environment. And yet I don't realize how dependent I've become on those little plastic bags.
A lot of people are going to find that out today.
I have a feeling they are.
A law that a lot of people on Oahu have been waiting for goes into effect today. Bill 38 CD2 bans most types of plastic bags in the city and county of Honolulu. But there are exceptions, and those exceptions are troubling to Suzanne Fraser, co-founder of Beach Environmental Awareness Campaign Hawaii. She's here to talk about the lengthy effort it took to get us here and the potential effect of loopholes in the bill. And Suzanne, let's starting out. Thanks for coming in, first of all. But
you're welcome. Good morning.
Let's start out by sort of saying what does the bill do? What doesn't it do?
So the bill bans a couple of plastic bags and allows people to switch over to different types of plastic bags.
Thicker ones.
Right. There's three different loopholes. You can use a thicker plastic bag. You can use a compostable plastic bag. And there is no ban at all on plastic bags for prepared food, drinks, and bakery goods.
Which is a fair number of plastic bags by your reckoning.
Huge, yes.
Does that mean we're unlikely to see, you know, the place people are going to be looking for an impact is really kind of at the shoreline, right? Because that's where a lot of the mess accumulates, and of course it does all kinds of damage in the ocean.
That's right. Plastic bags are in the top 10 most littered items that are found at beach cleanups across the nation. And we find lots of plastic bags at our beach cleanups, and they're generally from when people come to the beach with their food and drinks. So that's not going to change with this plastic bag law.
How did it come out this? Other counties have stricter ordinances, is that right?
Yes, Honolulu is not only the last county to get a plastic bag ban, but has the weakest ban of all four counties. We have three loopholes, and the other counties have one or maybe two loopholes, but we've got the most loopholes.
How did this come about?
There was Bill 10 back 3 years ago that banned some plastic bags, but allowed for biodegradable plastic bags. And when we heard about that, we let the council know that those so-called biodegradable bags are really just a plastic bag. And so it took us a couple of years to convince them to go back and revisit that bill. And so Bill 38 happened last year, and that was going to ban all biodegradable bags and compostable bags. But at the last minute, they changed the bill and inserted that you could use compostable bags.
What's the how is a bag defined as biodegradable? What's the difference? You're saying they don't biodegrade very fast, is what you're telling me.
They don't biodegrade at all. 1% of the bag is starch. That part does biodegrade, but all of the plastic does not biodegrade. Plastic does not biodegrade.
So how do you get to be designated as a biodegradable plastic bag? How is that delineated?
Actually, the Federal Trade Commission is going after companies that are calling their bags biodegradable because they're not.
So you're a biodegradable plastic bag if your manufacturer says so? That seems like a pretty light, a pretty vague definition.
Actually, it's the manufacturers that the Federal Trade Commission's going after. Yeah. They've taken them to court for that.
But in terms of the law, as defined in this new law, a biodegradable bag is one that is designated as such?
Actually, now biodegradable bags are banned because Bill 38 did succeed in banning biodegradable bags, but they've now replaced that with allowing compostable plastic bags.
So what's the difference?
So a compostable plastic bag will compost, but only in a high-heat commercial compost facility, of which we have none on this island. And unfortunately, if people see that word compostable written on there, they might think they could bury it in the sand or leave it in the park or litter it somewhere and it will compost. But the problem is that it takes 180 days in a high-heat commercial compost facility to break down, and in the natural environment, nobody knows how long it'll take, and it'll be definitely longer than 180 days.
What's going to replace the bags that everybody's gotten used to? Carrying a bag with you in your car?
Look, that would be the best thing that everyone could do, is to bring their reusable bag wherever they go. But we've done a quick survey over the last couple of days, talking to stores about what they're replacing their bags with. And some of the stores are replacing with paper bags. Mm-hmm. I think I had some statistics here somewhere about how many percent. I think it was 44% have gone for paper bags. Mm-hmm. But a whole bunch of stores are replacing them with these 2.25 mil thick plastic bags.
So the thickness of the plastic is part of the issue, yeah?
Unfortunately, but they're calling these thick plastic bags, like this one right here, a reusable bag. Yeah, this is supposedly a reusable bag. But, just because a bag is thick or just because you reuse it a few more times, that doesn't make it a reusable bag. I mean, if this gets a hole in it, who's going to go and get needle and thread and sew it up? Or if it gets dirty, who's going to put it in the washing machine? I mean, this is just a plastic bag, and that's what it is. It's
and
a
if
plastic
it,
bag.
And if it gets thrown away and ends up blown by the wind around on the beach, it's going to cause the same amount of damage, right?
Absolutely. I mean, plastic bags are plastic bags, thick or not thick, and they still float. They still will get ingested by sea turtles and other marine life, and they're still going to cause suffocation, blockages, starvation, and death. So really, this hasn't been effective with some of the many stores changing over to still another plastic bag, you know.
Well, you know, Suzanne, this is something that we see from time to time, that a bill that people have lobbied for a great deal of time passes with exceptions and emendations, and then it ends up unsatisfactory to the people who lobbied for it. Mm-hmm. But once a bill is passed, there's a tendency, both on the part of government and the public, to say, hey, don't we already have a plastic bag bill?
Yes, so we heard a lot of that this year.
Is your task going to be more difficult to get the rest of what you want done?
It's way more difficult. It was hard enough to get anyone to look at the county level, to look at this again last year and do Bill 38. Mm-hmm. But now we're hearing from both the state and the county that they don't want to touch any more plastic bag bans. And that's pretty terrible, because we're way far away from getting a full plastic bag ban on checkout bags here.
I would think the ultimate indicator would be what you see when you go to the beach.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Well, you'll I assume keep working on this and doing what you can, yeah?
Yeah, and I think it's up to the public too, because we can't take this huge load on ourselves to convince these lawmakers that there's so much more to do. I think people can take lots of action. They can talk to their store about it and refuse those plastic bags. They can go talk to their council member and reps about it. They can call the Department of Environmental Services. Certainly that happened on another island and change was made. So it is possible with the public's help. And I want to thank all of those stores that have done the right thing and changed over to paper bags.
Well, you're going to stay on the case, Suzanne.
So definitely.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Suzanne Fraser is the co-founder of Beach Environmental Awareness Campaign Hawaii. And you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, the Honolulu Museum of Art puts the focus on its homegrown artists. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, O Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of our island chain's most spectacular sights, one that doesn't get as many visitors as it might. It's at the end of a challenging hike that doesn't offer much in the way of shade or water. Its name in Hawaiian means the heat, and many a weary hiker has learned the reason why. It's the westernmost tip of land on its island, at the end of a road that peters out into a foot trail. The challenge of getting there is more than worth it, though. You're likely to see basking Hawaiian monk seals, wedge-tail shearwater, and Laysan albatross fledglings, along with a variety of rare native plants. They're all under the protection of the state of Hawaii, which has designated the site as a natural area reserve. Its offshore waters are great for snorkeling, and a good place for visitors to get acquainted with Hawaii's state fish, the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apua'a. We're looking for the name of this rugged beauty spot, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Good morning, I'm Andy Char from Bluegrass Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Contemporary art is not created in a vacuum. And all of the local, national, and global issues that affect our daily lives also affect our perceptions and how we view the world. It's that inspiration which artists use as their canvas to showcase their emotions about the world around them. Curator Healoha Johnston knows about what it takes to make art happen, and she is currently here to talk about the Arts of Hawaii at the Honolulu Museum of Art, a new exhibit that opens up today and is going to be there through September. Tell us a little bit more, Healoha. Welcome to The Conversation. And how are these artists being chosen for this 61st exhibition?
Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
The Artists of Hawaii exhibition that opens to the public tomorrow, July 2nd, was actually a juried process that included the museum director, Stefan Yost, the deputy director, Allison Wong, and the curator of contemporary art, my colleague, Jade Jensen. And the artists, I think 249 artists, submitted applications. And from that, they selected not necessarily artworks, specific works, but artists who they thought were making important comments through their work and whose work they thought could work well together.
So now these were all people who were residents. The artists are all residents of the islands.
That's right. So this exhibition, I think there have been 61 Artists of Hawaii exhibitions. And this show, like the others, features work from Hawaii, produced by artists who are living in Hawaii.
So now what's unique about some of the themes of some of these artists? One of them, I think, a few months ago we had on the show, Allison Best. And you can see, if you go to the website of the Honolulu Museum of Art, you can see what looks like a gorgeous sunset. But that's not what it is.
That's right. So Allison is one of the artists featured in this exhibition. And when you look at her photographs, you think you're seeing a beautiful sunset until you look at one of the photographs in the show, which includes what appears to be two sunsets. And you start to question what it is you're really looking at. And they are, in fact, oil tankers out on the horizon line, out on the water, delivering oil to Oahu. And she's playing on kind of the familiar images that have defined Hawaii, such as the sunset, the beautiful sunset on the ocean.
Yeah, when you see two, you know something's going on. So this is very contemporary art, but also it's reflecting some of the things that people experience right here in the islands, maybe in a way that is different than people might expect.
That's right. That's right. I think that all of these artists are interpreting the contemporary experience, and they're playing with some of the historical tropes, such as Allison, you know, playing with these ideas of the romantic sunset that we think we might be looking at, but in fact we're looking at oil tankers. And another artist, there's another photographer in the show, Alisa Chang, whose photographs of Waikiki are not the posed and lovely photographs that we're all used to seeing dispersed about Waikiki, but instead she's taken almost awkward moments that people have had there on the beach.
Now that's something I want to see, because I think a lot of us have had awkward moments on the beach.
I mean, in a couple of instances, she's photographing people taking their own pictures, so taking selfies on the beach, and she's looking at how tourists interact, and it's a very different perspective of Waikiki than the one that we see promoted.
Well, and I think a lot of folks, a lot of local people try and avoid Waikiki just because they don't want to be amongst all of the touristy kind of crowd. Or it's not even the people. I think it's just knowing that that's not the real Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting to see that an artist went there and said, let's capture what really happens.
That's right.
People taking selfies. Doesn't matter where you come from. Doesn't matter if you speak English or not. Everybody has been taking the selfie. So these are some of the artists that'll be at the exhibition. Is there a theme going on for all the different art that has been selected from the jury?
There's not one particular theme, but there are a couple of different themes that come through. One of the themes that comes across is this concept of the narrative. You know, we talked about Allison's work. You know, she's kind of considering the narrative of Hawaii as the beautiful paradise, and she's deconstructing that. And then there's an artist collective. So the exhibition consists of seven artists and one artist collective. And the collective is a group of printmakers. And they are interested in creating these, they're prints that are actually created manually, but construct what looks like a pixelated image. And the viewer is compelled to try and piece together these pixels and create a story there. And they kind of interrogate our need to create a narrative when we look at art. Another artist, whose name is Miley Iwata, she creates these really fantastic sculptures. They're ceramic sculptures. And then she photographs them and creates this little context, but she doesn't give you all the information. And so you're left trying to piece together the story that involves these figures and then the photographs behind them. There's also a lot of wordplay that's going on. Miley's work, for example, one of the figures is a young man who has stepped in gum, and the title of the piece is called Some Gum Guy. And it plays on Hawaii's Asian diaspora that, of course, has been a part of our ethnic milieu for generations now.
Well, and there's a lot of different ways that I think the art is reaching out to the people who are looking at it, to the rest of us, but also sharing a little bit of the contemporary experience that the artists are having. They're telling us something, and it sounds like if you are willing to listen, you're going to get some really interesting information from the perspective that these artists have.
That's right. And a lot of the works interject humor, wordplay, as we've talked about, you know, the deconstructing stories and narratives. There's a lot of interesting things to see in this exhibition.
Now, you're the first curator that the Honolulu Museum of Art has for Art of Hawaii.
That's right. Yeah, so in the lifespan of the museum, they've never had anybody up until January of this year that was devoted to the Arts of Hawaii collection.
So what does that entail for you?
Well, for me, it means looking at Hawaii's relationship with the world through its visual culture. And the collection includes works from 1700s up until present time.
So really all of the art that spans that entire time frame, which is, you know, several hundred years, that's all under your purview.
It is. And actually, my purview goes up until 1970. And then the contemporary art curator, Jay Jensen, who curated the arts of the Artists of Hawaii exhibition, kind of takes over at that point.
And to culminate this exhibition, there's going to be a time when people get to hear from you. Maybe towards the end of it, towards September, you're going to be there to give just a lecture about what your experience and what other artists' experience have been looking at contemporary art.
That's right. Situating Hawaii within the global experience through art.
So if you don't have a chance to see it until September, you can get more explanation at that time. You're going to help the rest of us, the art naive, of which I include myself, to understand really the genesis of where this art is coming from and what it's speaking to every one of us about. So thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing about the festival that's starting now.
Thank you so much for having me.
To learn more about the exhibition at the Honolulu Museum of Arts of Hawaii series, see selections from the artists, and hear more from Healoha Johnston, check out our website at hpr2.org.
Million yearning to be free.
There are some folks who think that coming to the United States is like getting to heaven. We consider the United States as a symbol of freedom.
It's the crisis of many crises. Never in history have there been more refugees and displaced persons in this world than there are right now. How can the U.S. help? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You can see 100 years of history on the walls of the state capitol, where every governor of Hawaii going back to territorial days is honored with a painting on the wall provided by this Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts. Governor Abercrombie's image is not there yet. The project is overdue and over budget, and thereby hangs a tale. Chad Blair has it in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
In this case, brush has not yet touched canvas, right?
The former governor hasn't even actually selected someone to paint him, although apparently just last week or so, he did narrow down the list to 7 artists, he and his wife, Nancy Carraway. But, you know, usually the painting of the outgoing governor gets put up while that governor is still in office. I remember Linda Lingle. Just before Governor Abercrombie was sworn in 2010, she actually had her portrait unveiled. Mm-hmm. It was a ceremony at Washington Place, and she actually chose a local artist, which is a departure from the norm. But with Governor Abercrombie, you're absolutely right. It is over budget. About $45,000 has been approved. There was a 9-month timeline to get this thing going, but in fact, that's not the case. The earliest we could see a painting for Governor Abercrombie would probably be January, probably later than that.
And that's after an artist gets picked by a committee.
Right, exactly. And these paintings, by the way, you know, they go up in the Capitol. The most recent governors from Bill Quinn on are actually in the ceremonial room where mm-hmm. governors sign bills. Interesting, because if Governor Abercrombie's painting gets done, they're going to have to do some rearranging because there's not a lot of room left on the walls there. Governor Ige will actually make that decision as to where to actually hang Abercrombie's portrait.
Well, this is traditional in state capitals and, of course, in federal facilities throughout the country, you know, the wall, a portrait gallery of those who have served in the top spot before, right? This is
right, exactly. It is the tradition. And you mentioned that, you know, they go back 100 years or so. You can actually look at those paintings on our website, the story that Nathan Eagle has up today. We have a carousel, and you can press and go and see them all. It goes back to Sanford Dole. Governor Abercrombie, you know, Nathan Eagle actually spoke to him. And the governor's been busy, the former governor. He's been traveling. He started his own consulting business in Chinatown. He did finally meet with the Hawaii State Foundation and Culture of the Arts director just last week or so, and seems enthusiastic about getting the project taken care of. It seems just a little odd. By the way, I don't think it's going to be him with his ponytail and the yellow cab, right? I mean, that's kind of the Neil Abercrombie that so many of us remember. In fact, that yellow cab took a starring role in his unsuccessful reelection bid last year. But the former governor was joking that maybe that ponytail, he kept it sort of as a vanity thing because he was losing his hair on his head. That's nice of him to say something like
that. Well, it's certainly, you know, I mean, if it were to be such a portrait, it would be the image that a lot of people have in their minds of former governor.
Right, exactly. And it'd be interesting what he does decide to do in terms of a theme. Governor Lingle, for example, had her portrait taken with a lei on. I believe the only governor to do so, Ben Cayetano, like Lingle, had his portrait taken outside the Capitol. He was actually in front of Washington Place. So you can see all those portraits on our website, and hopefully we'll get to see what Neil Abercrombie picks soon.
Well, thanks, Chad. I'll see you at the unveiling.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. Bert's on the line, and you know, Bert, I think about what I get done on the weekend, and it's not anywhere near what your group of the Startup Weekend get done.
Well, you know, I think it's probably, I'm in the same camp as you are. You know, this Startup Weekend is 54-hour intensive focus on creating a startup is for the younger people and
those with
the
energy,
young at heart,
Bert. Yeah, thanks.
They basically get sequestered in a place like the Box Jelly co-working space, and they get focused on an idea. And at the end of that 54 hours, they basically do a pitch and talk about what it is that they came up with. What we will feature today on the show are three of the teams that won recognition. And what's interesting is that these sort of teams and ideas get generated by the folks that attend. Of course, you know, they could be anybody. And in this case, we've got somebody who's going to be presenting. He's the first prize winner, and he's 15 years old. So, hey, you know, you don't have to be 20-something or 30-something. 15-year-olds, boy, I tell you, they're pretty articulate. They're pretty passionate and very, very intelligent.
Wow, 15, putting the rest of us to shame. Now,
we'll talk about their ideas, talk about, you know, what they have planned, what's the next step, and, you know, what was the big takeaway from participating in Startup Weekend?
Absolutely, and these businesses may eventually even be created.
That's right.
All right, it sounds like it's going to be something to hear about, to hear from those who are taking over the next generation and see what they're doing and learn from that.
They're already there.
They're already there. That's Bite Marks Cafe today at 5 on HPR2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
¶¶
As we were reminded in yesterday's Civil Beat discussion of Governor Ige's planned vetoes, Hawaii remains the only state without a sex trafficking law. The governor has said the bill as written, that was passed by the legislature this session, as written, is untenable with loopholes that could make law enforcement's job more difficult. That's troubling to Catherine John of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, who worked long and hard for the passage of SB 265. She's with us to give us her perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Let's define sex trafficking law, because obviously prostitution is illegal in Hawaii, but what's different about a sex trafficking law?
Right. Prostitution is still illegal. We didn't change that. But the difference between prostitution and sex trafficking is that sex trafficking involves the forced, coerced, forcing or coercing a person into the sex trade against his or her will, or controlling children, making them into prostitutes.
Which accounts for a great many kids on the street.
Yes.
Engaging in prostitution.
Hawaii has a really big problem with child trafficking that still hasn't been addressed, and we were hoping that the sex trafficking bill, if passed, would address that, and it would if it passes. We're concerned about a lot of the misleading statements coming out of both the prosecutor and the governor's office. Really, essentially, what this boils down to, and the reason why they say this bill is faulty and would prohibit proper prosecutions of sex traffickers or pimps, is because essentially the way they've been doing these cases is by criminalizing the victims. And so we're appalled, straight out. So even the sex trafficking victims, they want to force to testify, treat like criminals, and say, if you don't testify against your trafficker, we don't care how much danger that puts you in. We're going to charge you with another offense.
Well, that's, in police terms, that's how you make a bust. You bust a girl for being a prostitute, and you say, okay, we need you to hand in your pimp and or else.
Right,
like,
and there's
under threat.
Right, but there is actually a law that covers that. It's called promoting prostitution. Mm-hmm. If that girl or woman is forced into prostitution, that's when sex trafficking kicks in as a Class A offense, the highest penalty in Hawaii, and you have to treat them as victims. Now, the prosecutor has said over and over again in last session during hearings that he does not consider even sex trafficked victims.
Do they cite a difficulty in proving that someone was coerced into prostitution? Is that part of the issue?
Well, it's not too difficult. It is a challenge, but that's what separates promoting prostitution from sex trafficking. If there's an element of force, coercion, threat, or fraud, then it boots it into a different category entirely. Now, with regard to children, there's no need to prove those elements. And so even more for children, the reason why the sex trafficking law is so important is because police and prosecutors still have the ability to criminalize and put in prison juveniles who are sex trafficked.
If you're a juvenile who is in the life as a result of sex trafficking, everything in your life is a form of coercion, whether it comes from the police or from your pimps. Everybody's coercing you, mm-hmm. is what it sounds like that their landscape mm-hmm. is from the way you're describing it.
Mm-hmm. Most of our survivors that we've helped to realize their healing potential have been recruited as children. About 85% of our survivors fall into that category. So they age into prostitution as adults, and you know, people consider them, you know, lifers, or you know, they choose this lifestyle, which really it's not the case.
But there is a lot of rhetoric around to that effect.
A lot of rhetoric because you know, these traffickers steal away the most important years of a developing young woman's life when she should be in school or getting some sort of job skills and perfecting her character. They steal that away to use her for sex.
Well, it's to me, it's no accident that your organization is called the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, because you're deliberately putting a very dramatic term to it, because if you're doing something without pay against your will, that's what it is.
Right. You know, I'd also like to pinpoint another point of argument that the prosecutor and the governors bring up is the quote-unquote loopholes that they are desperate to bring out in the bill, which really are non-issues that could be settled by any judge if this law was implemented. And then the governor says that he's going to leave the issue with Doug Chin, our attorney general. What we fear with that incentive is that the attorney general and the prosecutors who are already against a victim-centered sex trafficking ban because they don't want the abusive sexist paradigm to change with regard to how they bust traffickers and criminalize the girls who are victims, is that they will create a cosmetic sex trafficking law to appease the public while keeping the existing laws intact, allowing prosecutors and HPD to criminalize the victims.
I'm puzzled that it would be in anyone's interest to keep what you describe as an abusive sexist system in place. I mean, the layman's perspective on this is, doesn't everybody want the same thing?
People will say that they want the same thing, and nobody will outwardly say that they're against sex, that they are for sex trafficking, that they're for criminalizing victims. A prosecutor has actually done that, but you know, people are smart enough to say the right thing that everybody wants to hear. But the proof is in the pudding. You know, in practice, how these laws play out are very, very different, and we have witnessed the successes that we have been responsible for with treating victims as victims throughout the court system, where they want to actually testify once they feel safe and they can trust somebody. What hasn't worked, and we've seen time and time again, are how many survivors who are forced to testify and their case gets dropped.
At which case they are targets of retaliation.
Exactly. And that's got to end, because the prosecutor, nobody can help them at that point, and the prosecutors just turn their backs.
There's a sea change needed from your perspective in terms of how society views this crime and the people engaged in it.
Yeah.
Sounds like to me.
Yeah. The light at the end of the tunnel is that every year that we try to pass the sex trafficking law, and it's been 10 years now, we educate more and more general public, and they get really upset at the lack of leadership, and they will not be fooled by politics.
Well, we'll see where this goes, Kathy. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Chris.
Kathryn Zion is the Executive Director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, and you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Allison Best, and I'm a photographer. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking at a popular but challenging destination for hikers on the western tip of Oahu. Its name in Hawaiian means the heat, and hikers who didn't bring enough water for the trip have learned the reason why. It's home to a variety of native plants and animals, protected by the United States' first predator-proof fence, constructed in 2011. The fence is credited for an increase in the area's population of wedge-tailed shearwater fledglings and Laysan albatross fledglings, and a greater number of ohia and sandalwood trees. Along the coastline, which boasts a white sandy beach that runs from the western tip of Oahu to the Waianae Mountains, you're likely to see Hawaiian monk seals. The area has been designated by the state of Hawaii as a natural area reserve, and we were hoping you could tell us its name, which is Kaiana Point.
And Warren Haynes of Kahului, Maui, knew the answer. Congratulations, Warren. I don't know if you're the same Warren who plays lead guitar for the Allman Brothers Band, but congratulations either way. At 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Lots of people have ideas on how to help the homeless, but some cities have taken a very innovative approach, and thanks to Dr. Jonas Vibel, Honolulu ranks among them. Offering an opportunity for local artists, writers, designers, and editors, The Word on the Street is a locally sponsored magazine that those in need can use to empower changes in their lives. Dr. Jonas is on the line to share his take on how a hand up may be better long-term than a handout. Dr. Jonas, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about The Word on the Street.
Yes. So Word on the Street, it's micro-entrepreneurship and a magazine centered around the magazine. So basically, it's a model that exists in many cities in the world and has been proven effective to gradually build up skills and give homeless people a little bit of income and a fresh start in life.
So how does it work? So there's a publication, and how does that translate into job skills and income for those who might be disadvantaged and homeless?
The biggest street paper in the world is called the Big Issue, and exists in many cities across the world. And the basic idea of how it works is that a magazine is produced, a high-quality magazine, and homeless people can sell this magazine on the street. All the income goes, or as much as possible of the income goes to the homeless vendors. And this enables people who haven't been able to get jobs and who live on the street to get a little bit of income and help themselves get out of homelessness gradually. It allows them to have a flexible income as opposed to many jobs where, for example, people have minimum wage jobs and get locked into certain times when they have to work. And so this enables them to either top up their income and get more flexible kind of both finances and social skills and learn entrepreneurial skills.
So, like, if the magazine costs about 50 cents and someone could sell it for $2, that extra $1.50 they can use to help support themselves, their families, their loved ones, and really get that step up you're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. So, they usually sell it for $2-3, and
Sure.
It would go to the vendor.
Absolutely. And now, who writes for the magazine?
So we have a bunch of different groups. We're a group of four volunteers working on this, and about 40 other people helping us with writers, photographers, designers, and other types of support. So we've had different groups writing for us. For example, we've had writing programs at different schools helping us. We have one award-winning writer who is helping us to write, and we also have support from some of the more professional magazines in town.
Would the only way that you could acquire this magazine be to purchase it from someone directly as opposed to going to a grocery store or a convenience store? Is the only way to get it from the people who might be benefiting the most?
Yeah. So that's the idea behind it. It's a nonprofit organization, and all the money gets flowed back into the organization, and as much as possible of that goes to help the homeless vendors. So that's the general idea behind it.
Great. So give them a chance to purchase the magazine at cost, sell the magazine, keep the difference after they've paid their costs, and really use that money to help them to have a flexible work environment that might not require some of the things that getting a regular job would require.
Yeah. So I met a formerly homeless man in another city, and he said this was the best thing that had happened to him. At first, he was a bit skeptical and thought, oh, why would I want to be out there on the street selling these things, and what if someone recognizes me? But then he, upon recommendation of a friend, he started selling the magazine, and he had had a lot of debt. He had been chronically depressed, and he had been doing a lot of drinking and drugs. And this starting selling this magazine enabled him to have something to build upon. So he gradually started paying off his debt. And when he had paid off his debt, he realized that his depression was not as chronic as he had thought. So, and he also realized that because he was no longer depressed, he didn't have the same need to drink and do drugs. So this new focal point in his life really helped him to get out of all of these different trouble spots he had been in.
Well, and that type of success story sounds like it really is the reason why you're helping to bring this paper selling way to help the homeless here to Honolulu.
Yeah, I've been thinking for a long time on different models how we could help the homelessness situation here in Honolulu, and God knows we need it. So I think this is a great vehicle for it won't be a panacea and solve all type of homeless problems, but it will enable a good chunk of people to help themselves out of homelessness.
Well, and
a magazine in Nashville, the Contributor, which enables at any time it enables 400 people to sell these magazines, and it was so popular they had to cap it at that. But well, it's a rotating kind of opportunity for people to get out of homelessness.
Now, how often will the issues come out?
At first, we are aiming for once a quarter, and then depending on funding and support, we want to ramp it up to a monthly issue if possible.
All right. Well, it certainly sounds like we've got to keep our eyes out and be looking for this magazine and look for those who are selling it so that we can help them as well. And it's a great way to feel good about doing something positive, not just learning about what's going on the street and reading the word, but also helping those who need it. So thanks so much, Jonas, for sharing your dedication to helping the homeless with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. We appreciate your support.
Absolutely. Word on the Street is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing a locally sponsored publication that is a showcase for our Hawaii talent and also an opportunity for those who may be homeless to get a chance to help rebuild their lives. To learn more, you can check out our website, hpr2.org.
On August 9th, HPR brings you a special gathering of Slack Key Masters Keola Beamer and Jeff Peterson, Kumuhula Moanalani Beamer, bassist and vocalist Nathan Aviau, and dancer Kavena Meckler. It'll be an afternoon of favorite tunes from back in the day and a celebration of Hawaiian music today. That's August 9th at the Palikū. Reservations at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. sponsored in part by Servco Toyota dealers and the Toyota Prius.
Kathy, it was good to hear about word on the street, because it's sort of asking the homeless people what they think, which there's been fairly little of in the dawn of this whole controversy, yeah?
Well, and I really like the idea that we can empower them to do something that could really help them. I mean, and a lot of times we want to give them something but not help them really take a step up and find a way to find a home, to build their lives and get things back together.
Well, there's more attention lately being paid to paths out of homelessness, of which there are few, and there have been some serious obstacles. And now we're seeing more movement toward knocking down some of those obstacles, because it's not easy to get out of it.
No, once you go in that spiral and you really are needing help, we all have to work together to make it happen.
There's hope. I hope. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, Sun Run's Director of Public Policy, Robert Harris, talks about Hawaiian Electric's proposed solar tax increases.
Plus, we'll hear about the Hawaii Performing Arts Society Summer Festival and how they partner aspiring music students with teachers and performers from around the world. And also a Vietnamese cinema series right in our own backyard.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@Hawaii Public Radio or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want to past one, find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on hpr2.org. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of the conversation.